We have a couple of very weary people on this panel today. People who stayed up way too late while the Braves played Houston. But they've promised, I'm not going to single them out. And you won't hear that they're tired because they bring enormous energy when they come on Political Rewind. So I'm not worried about that at all. Welcome to a brand new week here at Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut and glad to have you with us as we start the month of November here in Georgia and around the world. We've got a panel of great journalists today to talk about what's going to be a very busy week in politics in the state of Georgia. So let's get right to it. Jim Galloway is here because it's Monday. He joins me on the Monday shows. He, of course, is the former political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and one of the great veterans of Georgia journalism. How are you, Jim?
Oh, I'm bright and cheery. I when I went to bed, the Braves were leading. I don't know what happened, what you guys did to them, but there you have it.
I noticed in the jolt this morning, Patricia Murphy bemoaned the fact that because the Braves lost last night, there's going to be a game on the same night as we're counting election returns in municipal elections around the state. And if there's a game seven, it's going to take place on the evening after the first day of the reapportionment session, which starts down at the state capitol. So when I said a busy week for politics, a busy week for baseball as well. We're also joined today by Margaret Coker, the editor-in-chief of The Current, the nonprofit news online news publication that is based out of Savannah. Margaret, thank you for being here.
Glad to do it. Didn't like the way that the ball game ended last night, but that won't stop me from appearing on your show, Bill.
Thank you very much. We also, without, you know, saying too much about it, you as a young girl saw yourself as becoming a female Major League Baseball player, you told us right before the show. That's really interesting, Margaret.
Yeah. The first, thank you very much. Yes, I grew up in an age where I actually learned my math skills in large part because I was scoring baseball games. So it was my first passion. It remains my passion. Go Braves.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. Riley Bunch is with us, a public policy reporter at GPB News. Riley, I imagine that you're not going to be able to escape doing some work down at the General Assembly when the special session starts, right?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, I do have Stephen Fowler, who is all over that for GPP, but happy to help where I can. And we're going to see some committee meetings that don't have anything to do with redistricting. So it'll be very busy, busy. We start this week. It's going to be crazy.
Yeah, we know that in addition to drawing the new political maps, there's also going to be a committee hearings on this notion of a city of Buckhead, which we'll all be watching very closely. And I'm very happy that we're joined today by the person who is really going to be busy at the Capitol, Maya Prabhu, who covers the state Senate for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And Maya has also been writing a lot about how redistricting plans are shaping up. Are you ready for it, Maya? Are you, you know, taking extra energy drinks? How are you? Are you working out extra hard?
I've stocked up on Red Bull and 5-hour energies to keep in the office, and it's going to be an interesting few weeks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here. Jim, let's start with municipal elections tomorrow. There are a lot of them going on around the state. Alpharetta's got a mayor's race, Tequila, Braselton, Marietta has a big mayor's race, the little town of Varnell, Georgia, a mayor's race, Fort Valley, Macon has a sales tax referendum, which would raise the sales tax by a penny in exchange for a rollback of the property tax. So there are races like this happening all around the state of Georgia tomorrow, Jim. It's a You know, we tend in our business to often not pay as much attention to municipal races. But the reality, Jim, is it's in cities and towns where people really work to get things done.
Right. And these races are officially nonpartisan. They often don't turn out that way. For instance, we've got in Sandy Springs, you've got Rusty Paul, Republican, running against a Democrat. And in, of course, the big dog in on tomorrow is the city of Atlanta. Where you've got Kasim Reed and Felicia Moore leading, according to the latest AJC poll. And this morning I got up early and started looking at today's kind of bullet points, and my question was. You know, the strange thing is you haven't seen Stacey Abrams weigh in on this Atlanta mayor's race. Well, if you take a look at the morning's jolt, one of her groups has. They've come out with an attack flyer aimed at Kasim Reed.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for mentioning Sandy Springs and Atlanta. I was kind of saving those simply because I think we're going to spend a little more time talking about both those races. But yes, the Atlanta mayor's race is getting an enormous amount of attention, as it should. The latest polls suggest, Riley, that it looks like we're going to see a runoff between City Council President Felicia Moore and former mayor Kasim Reed. But just to go to what Jim says, I was a little surprised that one of the political arms of Stacey Abrams' organization did issue a pretty strong attack on Kasim Reed that went out to people in the southeast part of the city.
Well, it is an attack very late in the game, and I think that's kind of what Jim was referencing. We haven't seen something like this, and I think it's a testament to how close this race is going to be. We have not had a clear front runner. You know, we expect a runoff between Kasim Reed and City Council President Felicia Moore, right? But there is an indicative in that poll and earlier polls this huge group of undecided voters. It's still kind of cats out the bag on this one. So I don't think it's surprising to see an attack from Stacey Abrams group at this time, but it really shows kind of the volatile nature of the race altogether.
Maya, we know that Kasim Reed's negatives are very high. And when you see things like an attack on him by a group associated with Stacey Abrams, when you see the Atlanta chapter of NAACP going after him until the national organization forced them to withdraw their very stinging criticism, it's clear that Kasim Reed, if he's going to be elected mayor again, he's going to have a lot of work to do to build back goodwill in the city, among many groups in the city of Atlanta.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of people and a lot of groups who probably align themselves with more progressive issues just don't feel comfortable or confident with Kasim Reed's leadership in light of the corruption probes from his administration and just who he is as a person, it seems. So there definitely will be a lot of work that he would need to do in order to try and repair some of those relationships if he ends up making it to the runoff and then becoming the next mayor.
Margaret, there has been some attention. I participated in a conversation. Cesar Mitchell, former city council president and an occasional panelist on this show, invited me to do a conversation with members of his professional fraternity about the mayor's race. And there were a lot of questions being asked by the people who were in that conversation about the relationship that we should expect the next mayor and a new city council, because we could see a pretty transformed Atlanta City Council. I think 5-6 seats could very easily will turn over. And I think that's a reasonable question. But I think for people, say, in Savannah, one of the more important questions in terms of why you would watch the Atlanta mayor's race is, what is the next mayor of Atlanta's relationship going to be for a year with Governor Brian Kemp, and then beyond that, with whomever is the governor beyond that? Because that relationship is crucial in terms of getting things done for the state and the city, yes?
For sure, yes. And, you know, I think that above and beyond the Atlanta mayor's position on that. You know, there's been plenty of other mayors, as we've seen across the state of Georgia in the COVID pandemic, who have really made a very strong alliance statewide in order to try and enact some what they consider common sense policies for public safety in the state. And so there is, I would even say, a greater attention, I think, paid in places like Savannah to who the next mayor is going to be to see if that those relationships can remain strong. I will say outside of Atlanta, I mean, here in Savannah, we also have some pretty important races. You said, you know, that local elections are really important because that's where a lot of crucial issues get decided. You know, the Port of Savannah is here, of course, in Savannah. It's one of the state's largest employers. Everyone is talking about supply chain disruptions and what that means for you know, national economic impact. Well, the two municipalities around the port are both having city council elections, Garden City, Port Wentworth. You know, the way that these local races are going to go could affect the amount of warehousing that's built around the Port of Savannah in the next 2 years and the amount of the pace at which those global supply chain issues could either be solved or continue disrupted for the state of Georgia.
Bill, if I could go back to the issue of Brian Kemp and the Atlanta mayoral race, I don't want to presuppose a Kasim Reed victory. Because I mean, even in his first two races, that was far too close. What I find interesting is that Governor Brian Kemp has really made Atlanta a whipping boy during this campaign, and I just wonder if should Kasim Reed prevail here in a runoff, if he makes it that far, his reaction and his relation that his reaction to that I think would be rather interesting to watch. I think he would probably be a little bit more forceful than Keisha Lance Bottoms has been in replying to some of Kemp's attacks. The other possibility, of course, is you could have at the end of next November you could have Stacey Abrams as a governor, and we've mentioned that the attack that an Abrams group made on Reed over in these last few days, their antipathy, just FYI, their antipathy goes back to Kasim, the first mayoral race that Kasim Reed won. Stacey Abrams was Lisa Borders' campaign manager. And they started not liking each other then, and it hasn't changed.
Oh, thank you for that bit of history. I had completely forgotten that. Nope. You know what? These things, you never forget in politics, the people who have been at one point or another your enemies. Riley, one of the other things that's interesting about a relationship between a Georgia governor and the mayor of Atlanta is we remember, of course, that Kasim Reed and Nathan Deal had a very strong partnership. And what they did was they agreed that there were many issues on which they would never, ever come to terms and agree. But they also believed that it was important to work together on issues that mattered. So, for instance, Margaret mentioned the Port of Savannah. Mayor Reed, who had close ties at that point to the White House, was very instrumental in helping with making the case for why Savannah needed the money for the deepening of the port. And in moving forward, if Republicans in the legislature in the next year decide once again they're going to try to take control of the Atlanta airport, you'd want to have a strong relationship between the mayor and the governor so that the mayor might have some influence on asking the governor to back off that. Those are just some of the kinds of dynamics that can be at play.
Well, you read my mind. I thought back to the debates when Kasim Reed was saying and boasting about how good his relationship was with Nathan Deal, right? So what is his reaction if he comes into office? And it's a very, very different dynamic with Governor Brian Kemp or Stacey Abrams, right? And I think the political climate has changed too since then. You know, we're seeing Atlanta as this kind of boogeyman, and that's what the Republicans are falling back on, and for a lot of things, for a crime especially. And we're seeing that leak into the smaller municipal races, like in Sandy Springs. I know we're going to talk about that. But the dynamic between the city and I think the governor has changed slightly in terms of the amount and severity of attacks on Atlanta for causing problems. So it will be interesting to see if, you know, like you said, if Kasim Reed gets into office, how he would handle that.
Maya, Jim did mention the Sandy Springs mayor's race, which is attracting attention in part because, first of all, Rusty Paul has served a couple terms as mayor up there. He has, I think, for the most part, been thought of as having done a pretty good job for the city of Sandy Springs. That doesn't mean it might not be time for a change. And the change that some voters are looking for is the opportunity to vote for the man who's opposing him, Dante Carter, who is the first African-American candidate to run for mayor up there. And we know and have talked about it on the show that there's been some race baiting surrounding his candidacy and the candidacy of a number of people of color who are running for city council for the first time up there.
Yeah, I think we tend to see that in municipal races, honestly, across the state, where voters are, quote unquote, warned about the election of Black candidates and how that could bring a version of Atlanta to their city or their town, where Atlanta, we're not, I think the latest census numbers show it's not a majority Black city, but Black residents are the largest racial group in Atlanta, you know, seen as a Black city. Atlanta, like Riley said, is seen as this boogeyman where there is crime and you should be afraid and you don't want that coming to your town. So we see that leaking into the Sandy Springs race and really municipal races everywhere where there are Black candidates.
Jim Galloway, one of the other things that we're going to see play out in all of the races across the state is they will take place under the new election law passed by the legislature, signed by Governor Kemp at the last session. And because these are smaller turnout elections, we presume, a lot of these things won't be tested. But Jim, one aspect of the new law that will be tested is that election organizations in each county are going to be under a new mandate to report to the state within 2 hours after the close of the polls, not the outcome of the election, not who won, who how many votes went to one candidate or another, but they're going to have to report the number of votes that they registered within 2 hours. And that, for some counties, like a Fulton County, given a volume of votes, that's a difficult deadline to meet. And right. It's one of the things that state election officials will look at to say, gee, Fulton County can't run its own elections. It's time for us to consider whether the state needs to take over their election process.
Yeah, it's very much weighted against Fulton County. Actually, most election in most counties, the election polls the polls close at 7 p.m. Atlanta and I think the rest of I'm not sure I think it's the city of Atlanta, not Fulton County as a whole. They have until 8 o'clock. So that does right. give them. And so most counties will have a 3 hour window. To count Atlanta votes, Fulton County will have a 2 hour window, and then there's another one. There's another requirement on top of that is all counties must have counted nonstop all absentee ballots and by 5 p.m. the next day. And that will put tremendous pressure on Fulton County. I think if you talk to Richard Barron over there, who runs those elections, he'd express some thanks that it's just a municipal election, although there are several Fulton County has quite a few cities, it's nothing but cities now.
Yeah, Margaret. Of course, these two measures in the law, I think you can see a direct line between them and all of the claims of fraud in the election last year. You know, Donald Trump complaining that at the end of election night he was the winner, and it was the votes that came in after election night, the fake votes that cost him the election. So, for instance, if you demand that that each election board give an accurate count of how many votes were cast, what you're essentially saying is we're going to make sure there aren't some extra votes that suddenly appear the next day that could throw the election illegally. It's all part of that same thing that Trump started.
Yeah, you know, politics is full of dirty tricks. I mean, I'm not naive. We know that in terms of campaigning, but I think it bears mentioning again that county election officials actually are our neighbors. They're not outsiders. They're not national political operatives. These are people who go to church with us and play soccer together. I mean, our kids and you know, we go to church together. These are people who take their jobs incredibly seriously. They are a fundamental cog in the wheel of our democracy. And, you know, we at The Current, you know, our mission is to revive fact-based nonpartisan news. And what we did last year a lot was just to write stories about this, the ways in which that election officials in our counties were going about the day-to-day business of preparing to run a very serious election so we could all trust the results. And I would say that those stories probably should be revived again this year. Election officials are people who are doing their best job, sometimes under extreme circumstances, like a clock ticking to get election ballots counted, but also, you know, again, the new laws in Georgia are somehow indicative of the fact that at least at a statewide level, we are presuming bad intentions by our county officials rather than good intentions, which is a shame.
Okay, let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. And when we come back, we have a lot more to talk about, including a preview of the special session that starts on Wednesday. I'll be interested in hearing the panel's reaction to some really interesting comments that the Lieutenant Governor, Jeff Duncan, made on this show on Friday, and a lot more after these messages. Jim Galloway, Margaret Coker of The Current, Riley Bunch, public policy reporter at GPB News, and Maya Prabhu, a State House reporter for the AJC. Maya, you're going to be following redistricting very closely, and you wrote a really nice preview piece for the AJC the other day. If you don't mind, I'm going to read your first couple of sentences to you and then let you weigh in. Georgia has changed, you wrote. It added 1 million residents over the past decade, saw shrinking white and rural populations, and witnessed Democrats winning statewide elections for the first time in over 20 years. Those realities will drive decisions by the Republican-controlled General Assembly when it starts redrawing the state's political maps next week in an intense and partisan process that will help determine Georgia's representation in Congress and the state capitol for the next decade. So the changes that you note, 1 million new residents, shrinking white and rural populations, Democrats winning statewide, those are factors which, were it not for the fact that political parties believe gerrymandering is the way to maintain power, would suggest that we could see a shift in the number of Democrat and Republican seats in the legislature and in Congress. But we're not likely to see much of that, are we?
We are not. You know, the party that is in control is the party that gets the say in what the lines end up looking like. And Republicans are not going to redistrict themselves out of seats. It's going to be interesting to see what their approach is going to be, if it's going to be shoring up the seats that they have and maintaining the majorities that they have, or if they want to make a play and try and flip some of these Democratic seats. You know, some political onlookers say that that is not the wise way to go. That might work well for them in the short term, but it won't work well for them because these lines stay in place for the next 10 years.
Jim?
Yeah, the main problem facing Democrats is Republicans, of course, is the depopulation of rural Georgia, and that's going to have to be balanced out. But just a little bit of elementary observation here, what you're the maps for the state house will be drawn by the House Republican Caucus. And whatever they decide will be approved by the Senate. So there will be no there's it's a very, very tight it will be a very tightly controlled issue. The maps for the state Senate will be drawn by the through an agreement within the Senate Republican Caucus. The House will have no say so. They won't meddle in the Senate Republican business. The real disputed map is going to be the congressional one, where those lines are drawn and how aggressive Republicans are being pushed from Washington to make Kevin McCarthy up in D.C. The House Speaker again. We've already seen that they're going after Lucy McBath and or Carolyn Bordeaux. They're trying to maybe we'll see them pushed into the same district and forced to fight it out. I would also I would point to the second district. Keep your eye on Sanford Bishop. I think that's going to be a target of Republicans as an extra pickup that they think they can get.
Yeah, Margaret, we're talking with Sanford Bishop in the southwest corner of the state of Georgia, where Sanford Bishop has held that seat for decades. And as Jim points out, there are some indications that Republicans may try to draw lines that will give Republicans an advantage down there.
Yeah, it is a zero-sum game, right? Redistricting, and the problem is in terms of having an engaged citizenry moving forward, is that studies show again from the right and from the left, when you have heavily gerrymandered districts, you have fewer people voting. You also have fewer congressmen voting. There's absolutely no reason through which they need to be active participants in this democratic system. They can coast, in other words. And so in order to get the best out of our elected representatives, generally speaking, having evenly contested races are good for both residents and for legislators, if they're actually serious about being representative public servants.
Riley, Jim already mentioned that it's conceivable that Republicans will draw a map that forces Lucy McBath and Carolyn Bordeaux, who of course hold seats separate from one another, 6th and 7th district, into the same district and having to compete against one another. You're welcome to comment on that. But we also know that we're hearing it's conceivable that legislative maps could be drawn that could put incumbents of each party in the same district and force them to fight it out too.
And that's going to be a concern for legislators in rural Georgia, right? Yep. Redistricting, any political scientist you talk to, they're going to say, you have no friends. I think that's what Charles Bullock always says. You have no friends in redistricting. And I think that puts an interesting spin on how Republicans handle it. Since they are in control, they are going to have to pit some people against each other within their own party, and that's never going to be fun, right? But the leaders will have ultimate control over that. Not only are they paying Democrats against each other, like you said, we might see Lucy McBath and Carolyn Bordeaux in the same district competing against each other. It's inter-party fighting, and I think that will be a really interesting thing to see in this session that we don't get to see except for every 10 years, right?
Maya, I think I want to go back to what you started with because I think it's important and will be of interest to watch. And that is this apparent split, which you reported among some Republicans over one of two choices. Do we, in fact, draw maps that will, in fact, assure and strengthen the power of Republican incumbents to be reelected in their districts? Especially, we've got to look at rural Georgia in that sense, I think. I may be wrong about that, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Or do they look at maps where they might have opportunities to move into Democratic territory and redraw a district so that a Republican has a chance at that? And that's going to be an interesting battle to watch unfold, I think, Maya.
Yes, definitely. You're going to have the more conservative wing of the Republican caucuses in each chamber pushing for not only the maps to keep the seats that they have, but also to go into some of these more Democratic districts, you know, probably some of the ones that most recently flipped from Republican to Democrat in the past 2-3 cycles. You're going to see that push. And, you know, when I was reporting that story, people pointed out that, you know, no one's going to be happy at the end of it. Even in the Republican caucus, you know, I'm feeling like they're going to be some places where they might make some reaches into some Democratic area to try and maybe pick up a seat or two in each chamber. And then there are going to be some places where they just work on shoring up the districts to make sure that the Republicans that they have in office don't lose their seat. And then of course, if the Democrats aren't going to be happy regardless. It's going to be interesting seeing that all play out. This is my first time in Georgia going through redistricting, so I'm excited and also a little terrified about what the next few weeks are going to hold.
Jim, quick final comment on this.
Yeah, I would say watch for the unintended consequences when a legislature targets somebody in the opposing party, for instance. In the 2001 redistricting, Democrats lumped Jack Kingston and Saxby Chambliss together in the first congressional district along the coast of Georgia. Saxby Chambliss decided not to challenge Jack Kingston for that seat. He ran for the U.S. Senate instead and ended up beating Max Cleland.
Yes, that's exactly right. And we also recall, those of us who are really, really old and have followed this forever, when Speaker of the House Tom Murphy tried to get Newt Gingrich to draw lines that would get him out of office. And not only did Newt come back and prevail, but he went on to lead the charge that gave the House control of Republican control for the first time in decades. So you're so right about unintended consequences. Okay, so let's move on. Speaking of the session, Maya, I assume you're going to be in the Senate for a lot of this, which you usually are. We had an interesting conversation, Patricia Murphy and I, with Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan on Friday. He, of course, has written a new book, GOP 2.0. He has moved away from the Republicans who continue to promote the big lie. He's looking for to chart a new course for Republicans. He sees himself as a leader of that effort. And one of the things that we thought was interesting when we talked to him was we asked him, when he went on his book tour up to St. Anselm's College in New Hampshire, was he in the back of his mind thinking this might be the way to start feeling out a possible presidential run? I want you to listen to at least a part of his answer, because what you'll hear what Patricia and I did, which is he didn't say no.
You know, we've got to convince tens of millions of folks that this is the direction, this is the path forward for the party. And, you know, we're going to take the next 3 years to do that. And if my name circled up in that conversation, what a great honor that would be. But that is so far from anything that me or my wife would be thinking about at this point.
I'm not sure, you know, with all due respect to the lieutenant governor, I'm not sure it's how far it really is from his thinking. If nothing else, it's clear that he sees himself as being in a position, since he came out front on this early, as being one of the national leaders of this anti-Trump effort, right?
Yeah, definitely. He was definitely one of the first Republicans in Georgia to push back on this this idea that Trump actually won the election in Georgia. And I think he has taken advantage of that that recognition that he's gotten nationally. You know, he's spent a lot of time on national television outlets. He has this book. He's doing the book tour. And, you know, it's difficult not to see himself kind of positioning himself and testing out the waters and feeling out if higher office is something that could be attainable for him.
Riley, we also asked Duncan how he saw himself presiding over this special session, considering that he's got a couple of members of the Senate, leaders of the Senate, Burt Jones, Butch Miller, running for lieutenant governor. You know, we've got a lot of senators who are going to be running for re-election in their own for their own seats. How he sees himself presiding. He said, quote, "I call balls and strikes even on my own team. I could care less about their campaigns when I show up and gavel in at 10 o'clock. I care about policies that move us forward." And he said he's not going to let the Senate floor become a campaign stop every day. I want to let's see how that works.
I was just going to say, we'll see how successful he is in doing that. You know, I think redistricting gives candidates in all races another platform to push whatever policies they want to do, get whatever clips they want for the campaign trail. And since Lieutenant Governor's not running again, he kind of has this shaky standing. How much control does he really have over his chamber? And I think that also goes back to maybe why he is banking on this more nationalized image of himself, right? He is banking on the fact that Republicans in the future will not be so tethered to Trump in the way that they are today, but that kind of pushes him out of Georgia politics right now a little bit. So we'll see how that all plays out. It'll be interesting to watch that Senate floor.
Margaret?
Yeah, you know, back in the day, you know, Georgia was known for revolutionizing and reinventing Republican politics under Newt Gingrich. And if another Republican can come in now and also reinvent national Republican politics, I think that Georgia's under the spotlight for a lot of reasons right now. That would be, I think, amazing for all of us on this panel today. We would like to see dynamic, common sense Republican policies enter the mainstream again.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. And when we come back, I want to look at a couple stories, one that was published by Margaret Coker in The Current and another from Riley Bunch at GPB News. We'll do that and more after these messages. Jim Galloway, before we turn to the stories I mentioned from Margaret Coker and Riley Bunch, quick item about the GOP U.S. Senate race. The Secretary of State's race in Georgia. We know that Brad Raffensperger was on Meet the Press. You sent me a quick note afterwards saying, wow, Raffensperger really went after Jody Heiss. Heiss, of course, running for that job. Raffensperger is trying to run for re-election. Let's listen. Chuck Todd asked Raffensperger, because he has a new book out too, let's listen to what he said about Jody Heiss to Chuck Todd.
Do you think Jody Heiss, if he's the next Secretary of State, would he be able to withstand the pressure from President Trump to overturn an election the way you did?
He hasn't shown it so far. In fact, when he showed up on January 6th, he voted to certify his race with the same machines, the same ballots that were used in his race. He certified that. And yet for the president's race, he voted not to certify it. And that's a double-minded person. And as a pastor, he really should know better.
If he's the nominee, do you think he can win the general election, or do you believe that it makes it easier for the Democrats to win?
Oh, I don't believe he can win statewide at all.
Ooh, Jim, as a pastor, he should know better.
Ooh. Oh, that's right. Yes. And again, Raffensperger he's pointing to the November general election. And I would have to, you may have wanted to talk about it later, but more about it later, but this very much parallels what Gary Black is about in the Republican race for U.S. Senate, his contest against Herschel Walker. I mean, the Black campaign issued, a packet to journalists noting all of Walker's assaults and trouble with violence, domestic violence. It's just incredible.
Well, as long as you mentioned it, let's talk about that real quickly, and I'll let you start it. So we know that Herschel Walker has picked up enormous momentum. His fundraising he's raising a lot of money. Most recently last week, Mitch McConnell, John Thune, the leader of the Republican Party in the U.S. Senate, the number two in the Senate, have endorsed him. It looks like Gary Black could be having significant problems winning that nomination. And yet he went to a shelter for battered women and really attacked Herschel Walker in the most strident terms, Jim.
Right. And again, just like Raffensperger, he's pointing to the 2022 general election. He's saying that yes, Herschel can make it through a primary, but if you put him in if you give him the nomination, you're going to tank the Republican chances for taking over the U.S. Senate again.
Yeah, what Black said was, among other things, I can't recommend that anyone vote for Herschel with a record like this. He needs to explain himself. Georgians will not tolerate an abuser of women. How can we have this as an example to our next generation, to our young people? Margaret, pretty strong message, actually.
Yeah, it comes back to this civil war going on in the Republican Party. There are people who feel very strongly about policies within the Trump faction. There are people who feel very strongly outside of that faction. And the question is, you know, which kind of Georgia do we have? We have it is a purple state. And those factions will need to unite if they're going to win state and national elections.
All right, let's turn, Margaret. You know, with the Ahmaud Arbery jury selection underway and with race being such a crucial factor in how jurors are being weeded out of the process, you published in The Current a very powerful investigation. You and your team went through data going back a couple of years into Glynn County police records to look at how race has played a role, influenced the actions of the department. Now, we're not going to get a chance to do the kind of deep dive that you've done. And in fact, Sam, let's post a link to this piece on on our social media. But Margaret, just give us an overview of what your investigation reveals about Glynn County.
Well, yeah, following up on this last conversational thread, you know, there are very strong views and emotions surrounding policing in the state of Georgia. And if you're a person of color, this is a time and place where your views are being aired maybe like no other time in modern history. And the views in majority Black Brunswick and majority white Glenn County that we're seeing over and over again is that police departments in Glenn County do not treat people equally. And we tested that perception, and we went and collected all the data we could, and we do see some troubling trends. We can't conclude that there is systemic racism in the Glenn County Police Department, but we can see that, for example, police police do pull over Black people more than their statistical population numbers would suggest that would be fair. We're seeing as well that they're in the state of Georgia, this very notorious catch-all phrase of suspicious persons. When someone calls 911 and sees someone that they don't know or don't recognize or believe shouldn't be in their neighborhood, call 911 and call it a suspicious persons. Police respond to that. And in Glenn County, over the last 3 years, something like 77% of suspicious persons calls are coming from majority white neighborhoods. Of course, this is indicative of the trial that's about to get underway, because in the Ahmaud Arbery murder case, the three defendants were calling 911 to report suspicious persons in their neighborhood. There's 18 such calls in the 6 months before Ahmaud Arbery was killed, and of course, at least two calls on the day of his murder. So it is a really troubling look at policing in our corner of Georgia, in Glenn County.
Do you think that there's now that the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, and the way in which at first white prosecutors refused to take action against the three now defendants, how much of an impact has that had, do you think, on the reexamination and on changes within the Glenn County Police Department? So, for instance, you point out in your article that back in 2017, only 12% of the officers on the police force were Black, while the county at that point was 26% Black. Now, the non-white officer percentage rose to 22%. So that's a move in the right direction, yes?
Yeah, I think if you are a person of color in Glenn County, you think of that as a move in the right direction for sure. But another finding that we have in our piece is that, you know, for all of the potential problems that Glenn County, the police department has, they were pointed out in a very comprehensive audit in 2017. And the changes that the police department is underway in conducting, they really haven't prioritized the issue of potential implicit bias or race. There's over 100 recommendations that this audit made, and race is not being prioritized in a way that many people would like it to be.
One other quick fact in this that I thought was interesting. You point out that 9/11 calls between 2018 and 2020 showed that 77% of the calls reporting, quote, suspicious persons came from majority white neighborhoods, suggesting that policing priorities and methods in Glenn County may be influenced by the biases of county residents themselves. And in a way, even though there was no 911 call in the Ahmaud Arbery murder, it's the same kind of situation there. He was considered by the three defendants a, quote, suspicious person.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, in the course of our 6 months of reporting, we've talked to a number of Black people who say we were raised knowing where we should be and where we shouldn't be. We sort of knew where we were welcome and not welcome. And in this jury selection process that's underway, what I found rather striking is that day after day, if prospective jurors are asked about these same sort of questions, and you're hearing over and over again by Black and white people, but predominantly Black people, saying, you know, it is rare that you would have seen a Black man jogging in a neighborhood like that. And that sort of shows the historic, I don't know, sort of the historic fear in some communities' DNA about what it means to be Black in Georgia.
It's a terrific piece of reporting. As I said, we'll put a link up on our social media to it. Maya?
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in, because I think you find that anytime a local news organization does a report or an investigation like this, you know, we see this across America, that people of color are stopped at higher rates. When they're stopped, they are cited at higher rates. You know, the number of times that I've lived in 8 states, number of times I've been pulled over for no reason other than to ask me where I was going. You know, it's something that happens. And then to the 77% thing, I think that another factor in that is that I think people in white communities feel more comfortable calling police when they see someone who they think is suspicious versus folks in Black neighborhoods, because historically, when you invite cops into your area, things don't always go well for you.
Okay, with a little bit of remaining time we have, and you deserve more time than this, Riley, you posted a pretty interesting piece on the GPB website. We'll put a link to that up, too. The headline, Kelly Loeffler wants Republicans to vote. Is she the right person to ask them? You really dug into what the heck Kelly Loeffler is doing these days, a question that a lot of us have wondered about. Tell us a little bit about that.
I know. It's a name we haven't heard for a while on the show. You know, the last time we heard from Kelly Loeffler, she had lost her race to now U.S. Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock and announced this kind of effort, Republican-led effort, to get more conservatives to the polls. And while a lot of people have criticized it as being kind of a copycat effort as Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight Action, it's this interesting dynamic that she's playing. She's an interesting political figure. She is going to local counties, local GOP, and she's trying to mobilize conservative voters and tell them, hey, this happened to me. I didn't get the votes, and now look where we are in the U.S. Senate with two Democratic senators. But she also played such a large role in kind of pushing people away from the polls, too. You know, it's largely accepted that Trump pushed his own base away from the polls with all these election fraud claims. And Kelly Loeffler, on her campaign, she tethered herself to that, and she was even going to object to the Electoral College vote. So the piece explores this interesting dynamic of her trying to fill the grave that the GOP kind of dug for themselves.
Yeah, right. Again, it's up on our social media. Thank you for that terrific report, Riley. We're out of time, completely out of time. Riley Bunge, Maya Prabhu, Jim Galloway, Margaret Coker, thank you for starting the week off with a terrific conversation. It's Election Day tomorrow. If there are elections in your community, go vote if you haven't done it already. We'll be back again tomorrow. In the meantime, take care, stay healthy, wear your mask. I don't know about, I got my booster shot over the weekend. If you're eligible for one, they are widely available right now. So go out and get one and get the flu shot while you're there too. See you all tomorrow.